Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. The old man of the Shakyas passed away some 25 centuries ago. Why do we still commemorate this event and for the monks to, why do we strive, as Kazen says, to follow after him, to emulate him? It really can't be because what he taught could be summed up by living in the present moment, or being nice, or all the things that are attributed to him that actually don't have much impact on people's actual lives. There's actually a website called Fake Buddha Quotes, which is very illuminating to look at. What the Buddha taught was something that is both very simple on one level, so simple that we tend to not pay any attention to it, and yet so profound as to be completely life-altering. There's the phrase, to turn about at the deepest seat of oneself. Everybody is aware of suffering. But the Buddha referred to it in a much more profound way than it is usually seen and usually understood. Because sometimes in the way that the Dharma is sometimes written about in this country, one would think that attaining a reasonable income in the middle classes and being able to obtain one's particular favorite variety of coffee and not be too disturbed by the news events is freedom from suffering. The Buddha also taught something, again, very simple and straightforward, and yet very profound. That is why it takes a lifetime to fully appreciate what the Buddha was actually saying. The profound sense of discomfort and, as he said, the entire mass of suffering. That is the illness. What is the cause of the illness? Selfishness. Usually when we read about the Buddha Dharma in books, it can be very abstract, the belief in a separate self, sometimes is what it says, or a false belief in the self, or trusting to the little self rather than the great self, etc. And much like instructions in meditation that only perplex rather than clarify, this is actually not of much help, particularly since we have to start where we are rather than where we wish to be. So the cause of suffering is selfishness. The poet W.H. Auden, who I'm fond of quoting, said, "For the error bred in the bone of each woman and each man craves what it cannot have, not universal love, but to be loved for ourselves alone." The Buddha was remarkable for pointing out what was in front of our noses and providing us with a means of doing something about it that happens to be very effective, but also deeply troubling. Because we have to do something about ourselves. And there is no escaping this. We can learn all sorts of exotic ways of meditating, take all sorts of exotic substances, go on all sorts of exotic journeys, find all sorts of exotic teachers. And the Buddha's teaching is, to some degree, nagging. Because it says you have to do something about yourself. And our response is often, "Oh, but I need to do something about the world situation, even if it's only worrying about it." Or, "Oh, but I've got to straighten out this part of my life and finances and find the right job and find the right circumstances, and find the right partner before I can begin to do anything about myself." And the Buddha, not being a particularly pushy type of person, just would say, "Okay, and there is no way of dealing with suffering without addressing your own selfishness." When someone says what I've just said, what goes through some minds is, "Oh yes, of course, I know what it is to be, what selfishness is about. I shall avoid it." But my own experience of myself as well as teaching is that most people have no idea what the word selfishness even means. Now, a certain wise gentleman, William Shakespeare, wrote, again, one of my favorite phrases, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their entrances and their exits." And also, put in the mouth of Macbeth, one of the most profoundly despairing statements. "Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." Except, aha, a player upon a stage. The play has no significance, is full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. River Master Jiu used to have us in the very early days watch soap operas on television. Sometimes for hours, particularly if you were a chaplain. And I remember years later encountering somebody in Vancouver who said, "Why did she do that? Soap operas don't resemble real life." And I thought, but did not say, "You have obviously not watched enough soap operas." I even remember a reference to a lady who claimed to have cured herself from mental breakdown by going to a friend's house and lying on the sofa and watching soap operas all day. Gave her perspective. It is like a play. We enter stage left, if that's the proper entry, but in any case, we enter stage left. We have our instructions with us. Okay, based upon the previous play. Based upon the previous experience. Previous karma, previous lives. I always find the notion of that there was nothing before we entered this life and there would be nothing after it kind of quaint, because we are so obviously profoundly confused, and we didn't end up being that way simply through entering the birth canal. So the script says you will like this person. You will not like that person. You will be drawn suddenly to this stranger across a crowded room. You will dislike your coworker who you've never met before because of their annoying little habits that remind you of something that you can't remember. That you will be this type of person who votes this particular way. And that this will make perfect sense to you. And why other people don't think the same way will be an eternal mystery. And the cause of wars, of course. So, karma, if I can put it that way, or delusion, karma presents us with a script and is the director of the play. It's that that Shakespeare is referring to as full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. This particular metaphor is very wonderful from my perspective because one can explain so much in it. And then eventually we exit. What the Buddha taught, which is so profound and important, is the fact that we are in a play and that the secret is to stop in the middle of it. To stop and to sit down. And I'm not meaning to be facetious when I say stop, sit down, and do nothing. Just for half an hour. Don't try to add. Don't try to take away. Don't pick up. Just put down and sit. That's why meditation is so radically important in this, and why it is so important to understand what its purpose is. When we stop in the middle of the play, what do? And that's why the Buddha coupled meditation with precepts. Instead of following the plot, we stop. Now, monks make a particular commitment, which they don't always realize until many years later. When they get ordained, it's a commitment to stop. The lay commitment is to slow down, because one has one's obligations, and by slowing down, one helps other people, because it shows them that it can be done. I found myself practicing this when I went back to Newfoundland for a visit to my family. And I'm sure some of you must have families like this where one section of the family is not talking to the other section of the family and they don't want you to talk to whichever section of the family. So I found myself in a situation of wanting to go and visit somebody who the other person who I was staying with objected to my visiting. This was one of the occasions where I saw the value of the metaphor of the play. And then, of course, part of the play is to induce in you, because you're an actor, the emotions necessary for creating the verisimilitude of the play. So, you know, like, oh, if you're going to go and see that person who I'm not talking to, you know, I don't love you anymore, or, you know, all the usual things which are part of the soap opera. So, I decided, and I live, the entirely opposite side of the continent from my family. I decided to follow that particular advice and stop in the middle of the play and to do what I thought was a good idea, and which was I wanted to visit that particular person. And so I said, I'm going to go and visit that person. And they said, well, how are you going to get there? And I said, I'll take the bus. And they said, you can't do that. I'll drive you. And which had good result. But I also saw that the greatest gift I could give to members of my family was to let them go, to not try to get from them an apology regarding the past or an attempt towards an ideal future, but simply to let them go, to release them. To release them from their obligations, my perceived obligations that they had towards me. This, of course, is one of the profound difficulties of training in lay life with one's children. And the whole business of the letting go. As Master Ji used to say, children enter this world, the only thing they lack is knowledge about how this world at this particular period of time works. They enter the stage door with their own talents, views, plot. And as that statement with anybody coming from the 60s would recognize, your children dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot enter, not even in your dreams. Now, oftentimes, and I think too often for people's own good, people stand on the periphery of their training. They stand either just outside the door or just in the door or just inside and demand that the solution to the problem be presented to them before they will venture any further down the road. This sometimes manifests as saying one cannot know aspects of the Dharma for oneself. And of course one can know. That's the whole point. One can know for oneself how this works. The Buddha was visiting the Kalama people. And every time I go again near the town, that's I guess in Washington or Oregon, I always think of this, the Buddha's question and answer with the Kalama people. They said, many people come through here. They were talking about spiritual teachers, but you could also say the same thing about politicians, particularly in this year, in this country. And the Kalama said, they say various things to us, and they say all the other people are wrong, and we can't figure out, how should we go about figuring out who is right? And the Buddha said, leave aside the question of to who is right. Okay? Don't go by, I'll use contemporary words, don't go fully by the newspapers. Don't go by the articles on Wikipedia. Don't go because you've worked it all out and what somebody says seems reasonable. That's one of the things in the fake Buddha quote website. They point out that the Buddha did not say to try to figure out what to do by what seems reasonable. Don't go by something because it's written down in old books, and that includes religious ones. But the Buddha said, when you know for yourself something is helpful. And he gave as one of the ways of knowing, something is praised by the wise, leading to peace, then you should do it. When you know for yourself something leads to harm and is condemned by the wise, then you should not do it. This, of course, cuts down on a whole set of knowing. But what often people don't realize in terms of knowledge, that if we were to think of a fact that we know for ourselves, okay, we know that the sun is however many distance from the earth, okay, we can say, okay, this is a scientific fact. But if it should be discovered and published that the measurements were wrong and that now they've done new measurements, we would generally, without controversy, go along with those new measurements, even though we couldn't have measured it for ourselves. So most knowledge, if not all knowledge, is impermanent. It is knowledge about something that changes. Even our knowledge about ourselves. I am this way. My children are this way, which changes as those of us who have gotten at least past 55 have begun to realize, as I did, that all those ads about regularity had a particular meaning. Whereas I had no idea what they were talking about. So, knowledge in the usual way is obtaining something, obtaining a piece of information, shall we say, and that we'd kind of like hermit crabs, you know, who live in the shells, the abandoned shells of other creatures, and decorate them. And some of us are more along this line than others. We decorate our surrounding areas with the ideas and viewpoints and opinions. And we have them. As we say, we have an opinion or we have a view. Now, I'm going to digress a bit and hopefully find my way back to this particular point. Where Master Jiu used to use a term called filters. And one of the things she was referring to is a set of old-fashioned photography filters, you know, with different colors that you would shift in front of the lens. And she would say things like, you know, you try a particular filter in order to see how a thing looks. Well, all isms, if I can put it that way, including Buddhism, is a type of filter. You look through the filter in order to be able to see certain aspects of things more clearly. Okay, you look through the filter of a particular political view so that you can see certain aspects of it more clearly. You look through the filter called Buddhism in order to see how to go about really living, as I say, independent from that play. But if you think that the mere looking through the filter is the same thing as either realizing the truth or liberation, you're mistaken. And to fall into the filter, as many people do, causes great confusion. That is, when people mistake a certain political view for the way things are, in fact, instead of as a way of looking at them. And most things with an ism on the end of them are a filter, a way of looking at things so that bring things, some things to the foreground and other things into the background. And they are incredibly useful. Her master used to talk about carrying her set of filters with her. Sometimes it was simply to be able to understand where another person was coming from by looking through their filter. And there's nothing wrong with these, as I say. But if you fall into the filter, like Alice down the rabbit hole, and think that this is the way things are, then you're going to be very much mistaken. Master Jiu would sometimes frighten the living daylights out of people by picking up an idea or a filter and looking at things through it and then putting it down. It would frighten people because people didn't understand how you could look at the world through a filter without falling into it, without believing it. My first experience with this was when I took anthropology and took the French Marxists in anthropology. And I haven't been so thoroughly bored in my entire life. I just about passing out from the experience of ennui, you know, where one's eyes are rolling back in one's head, and one feels the slow climbing hot thing, you know, mush that is going to get to the brain. Anyway, so when I realized after coming here that it was a filter, and the professor was very helpful along those lines, it was quite illuminating. So any ism is a filter. So when people hear about spiritual knowledge or knowing or kensho, or even the experience of lesser things like seeing one's past existences or other realms or what have you, or other beings, based upon their experience of knowledge as obtaining something that you can decorate your mental castle with, they will not understand the nature of knowledge in a spiritual context, which is actually not obtaining something, but letting go. Spiritual knowledge comes from letting go of having to have a particular viewpoint. usually with knowledge in the usual way, people will get into great arguments and disagreement. Okay, about who they're going to vote for, or which party they support, or what have you. Or different views about how other countries should govern themselves. And spiritual knowledge is actually quite different. As a matter of fact, it is something where that spiritual people can interact with one another without the necessity of proving something true or not. Another metaphor for me along these lines is climbing a mountain in the sense of spiritual journey. And while a lot of people are fighting at the base of the mountain over their respective guidebooks, you know, one group of people saying, well, my guidebook says there's supposed to be plenty of water around here. And the other people saying, well, my guidebook says it's supposed to rain around here. And not understanding that one set of people is coming from a wet type of journey and others from a dry type of journey to reach the same mountain. And then, of course, it's much easier to quarrel. It's much easier to fight. It's much easier to quarrel than it is to stop. That's why the Buddha said, those who realize in the middle of this quarrel, this fight, in the middle of it, we perish. They have their fight stopped thereby. And as one climbs up the mountain, one is just glad to see other people up there as well. One doesn't care what route they came by or, you know, how they're dressed or anything along those lines. One is just glad to see them. My remarks are only about an infinitesimal part of what the Buddha taught and what the Buddha pointed out. And the depth of the treasure house, as Dogen calls it, is inexhaustible. We have to, however, do something about ourselves, trust in something greater than ourselves, and enter through the door. For as Dogen says, if we think knowledge of the Dharma is for other people than ourselves, this is the most useless of all useless opinions. Thank you.